beach easy.
I think I started just, it was crazy, but I realized all the things I've been missing and everything else, and it just, I was letting alcohol define me, and now I let other stuff that are positive define me.
Mm-hmm.
It defined me.
Yeah.
Holy crap. Alcohol helped define me.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. From personal growth and self-discovery to challenges and victories, we discuss it all. Join us as we dive into the extraordinary stories of ordinary people all the way to the end.
Welcome to Life's a Beach and Then You Die. I'm Julie, and today I'm talking with Inglis Glover, an outdoor lover with quite a story about how he got to where he is now. His journey begins in Lake City, South Carolina, where he grew up with his parents and two brothers.
I grew up in Lake City. If I ever grew up, my wife calls me Peter Pan. But I grew up in Lake City, South Carolina. I was born in Sherall and then moved to Florida for a little while when my dad was a golf pro. And then ended up in Lake City, where I spent most of my life, 28 years there.
How old were you when you moved there to Lake City?
I was four. I was four when we moved there.
So that was kind of the beginning of what you remember as your childhood. Not to give away your age, but what year was that?
That would have been 1977.
What was your home life like? Did you have siblings?
I did. I have two younger brothers. One of them is my next-door neighbor in Merle's Inlet.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And he is our baby brother. And as we always say it, he is the more mature of the three of us, probably. And then my middle brother, Warren, lives in Merle's Inlet as well. We all live in
Merle's Inlet. Oh, wonderful. You all landed there.
Home life was wonderful. Grew up in a very Christian household. My dad was a golf pro there in town at a local golf course there in Lake City, which is, you know, nothing fancy at all. But he chose to stay there throughout his career so that we grew up in that environment, so that we did not get lost in the numbers, lost in translation, turned down several jobs and job opportunities at other bigger courses for us to grow up there. And he had a good deal there. He owned the golf carts and he owned the pro shop. So he was making a little, you know, making money. I mean, life is what we make of it. We all know that. And it is great to come back, but go back to Lake City. But I cannot be any happier with the long, different journeys that brought me here to the Grand Strand.
Inglis had a wonderful childhood and loved growing up surrounded by golf. His relationship with his dad taught him about hard work and helped shape him into the man he is today.
I was blessed. My dad was my hero growing up. Like, you know, because I did not get pushed into golf. Let's go backwards. My granddad was very hard on my dad. He put him into golf lessons with a gentleman, God rest his soul, Grant Bennett, who I ended up taking lessons from too, who was very driven and was at McClinigan High School in Florence, and he pushed his students to be the best that they could be, albeit it could have been really, really hard pushing. But my dad didn't want me. Dad said he got burnout. He went to school, went to Memphis, and he got burnout after 2 years of the golf. And now, granted, he went on to the profession and stayed in that for 38 years. In the golf profession, it was all he knew, and he was good at it. Not just the playing side of it, he was good with members. He was good with, you know, taking care of that side of the business.
Was he a patient man? I mean, I think you'd have to be to teach people golf, because that's pretty tricky.
Like, oh, yeah. And he is very patient. He's still very patient. We laugh about it because he's so far different than the three of us, the three boys.
But did you do it because you loved it or because your dad expected
it? I did it. I think we both did it because we loved it. And I think we both did it, again, because it was what we knew. Yeah. And I don't want to say it was because it defined us, but I felt like it made us more than what we really were. You know, I truly believe that we had genes in us that led to us being pretty good golfers. I don't think it was, I know it wasn't lessons. My dad would not teach us. Like, he would help, like, a, you know, this, but we were both self-taught. Like, I didn't take lessons till I was in college.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah, I didn't take lessons till I was in college.
But dad didn't help you?
He just, if you came to him and said, hey, you know, I'm having trouble with my wedge and I really want to start keeping the ball lower, can you give me some tips? He would help with that. But as far as, like, you're going to be on the driving range every day, blah, 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 no, mm-hmm. that was not it. And we had an opportunity pretty much every day to go to the driving range if you wanted to go to the golf course. If you weren't up on that day and in the car with him when he left, we had to ride our bicycle, and it was 4.5 miles to the golf course. And we did it. We would ride the bicycle out
ways.
There, and then we put the bike in the back of his car and drive home with him at the end of the day. But, you know— his days, he was the golf course superintendent and the pro.
Oh, wow.
That's how small the golf course was. So he had to manage the golf course, keep the grass green, and run the pro shop and take care of all that. So his days were dark to dark, I mean, basically.
Why do you call him your hero?
Oh, because I just felt like I saw how much everybody loved him. I saw how much the members loved him there. And then, like, I would go with him. Well, we didn't have an opportunity. We didn't have an option. My mom worked, too. So if my dad had a golf tournament, and this is another thing, I look back and go, golly, I couldn't imagine taking my kids to go play in a golf tournament. My dad would take us. Like, one year, he won the Carolinas Open, which is one of the two biggest tournaments in the Carolinas. He won it at Baytree, the old Baytree golf course up there. We had no school, so I had to go with him. I had to go with him in the biggest round of his, at that time, probably the biggest round of golf. He had to worry about me running around and walking around the golf course while he was playing.
Wow. That's some focus.
Oh, it is some focus.
Yeah.
But it was just people, and granted, you know, if you go up to somebody and say, what do you think of my dad? Of course, they're not going to come out with the negatives. But I'm connected, and I get to hear a lot of things that I don't want to hear sometimes, and I've never heard anybody say anything negative about him. And yeah. I think that's where it comes from. It's not about the golf game. It's not about – it's just how he just genuinely treated people wonderful. And like I try to tell my kids, you know, treat people the way that you want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
Don't treat them the way they treat you.
Right.
If that's an issue, go away. Walk away. Leave them. You know, they're going to treat you that way. You don't need to be a part of them. You don't need them in your life. But I think that's where when I bring up the hero side of it, I think that's where it comes from. And then, of course, like we all do, we all think our dads hung the moon, or you should. I feel like you should. And I remember fishing as a kid, which is where I really got my teeth cut in fishing. Fishing as a kid, we'd come down to the beach and we didn't have a boat. We didn't have money to own a boat. We would rent from a little place called Cedar Hill Landing in Merle's Inlet. Currently, it's Graham's Landing Restaurant down there.
So you would travel to Merle's Inlet.
Yeah, we'd come to Merle's Inlet. Like
just south of Myrtle Beach.
That's right.
And when you were a kid, you did that.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
And he would bring all of us, all
Wonderful.
Three of us,
yeah.
and rent like this little 15-foot, 14-foot John boat with a 9-horsepower motor on it. And we would go out in the inlet, and I just remember some of the fishing trips, just catching so many fish. And I still to the day, because I fish Merle's Inlet, I'll say, Dad, you remember the one year where we caught all those trout, and we were trolling a white grub and this and that? And he mm-hmm. goes, what are you talking about? I'm like, remember, you don't remember when we caught it? He's like, how do you even remember that? I'm like, because I just remember it. I have a good memory. And because it was such an incredible time for me as a kid to have that opportunity with my dad and to spend that time with him. And like I told him, I said, that tells you right there you were doing the right thing. I still remember it. So it meant a
right.
lot to me.
Inglis loved playing golf, but after a while, he realized his heart wasn't in it. He went on to play in college and professionally, but eventually he decided to make a career change.
So I was at the end of a year contract with my sponsors, and they were going to have to shell out another $30,000, and back then that's a lot of money, another $30,000 for me to go play in tournaments. And I mean, we factored in cost of living and everything. And I just didn't feel good about it. I had probably only made 3 checks in the 6 months prior to this, and just didn't feel good about it. And I said, maybe if I go work for a while, maybe I'll realize how great I had it, and go back to it. You know, maybe I can go, I'll go work. I'll move to the beach. Great spot. My granddad's got a house in Merle's Inlet. I'll go live there. I'll go to work in the restaurant business. Wonderful. And moved here and got into restaurant business thinking, hey, maybe I'll get back into golf. And I did, but it was 10 years later. No, 8 years later, I tried it again. But
so you moved here permanently to work at a TGI Fridays, right?
When they first I ended came up at to TGI the Grand Fridays, Strand? But I think I told you, I figured I had no experience waiting tables, but I had worked for 3 years at one of the most prominent golf courses in the Carolinas where it is all about, you know, customer service. And right. I knew how to make people happy. I figured you put me in a situation where all I'm doing is taking their food order and serving them drinks. I'm going to make them happy. And, you know, I'm not the one cooking it, but something in between, I'm going to make them happy. Somehow or another, I'll figure out something to make them happy. So, but I got turned down by a lot of restaurants. And one of the problems was I was male. I didn't realize at that time it was more on the female side for waitresses. And then the bartender was the guys.
Yeah.
And again, this is 96, okay, when I know the year, 96. And finally, I went to this. I saw the TGI Friday sign out front, and I went, and I said, oh, my God, you know, I cannot wear those suspenders. I cannot wear those crazy hats. But went in, interviewed, and the managers all heard me say about golf. And they were like sticking their heads out from curtain. It was one of these mass interviews, you know. And all these managers were sticking their heads out the out of their little curtains and going, hire him, hire him. Because they heard I was telling them that I had connections and I played golf down here and stuff. And so. Yeah.
How old were you then?
I was 26.
26. And just starting something new to make some money.
Starting something new to make some money to hold me over until I could get my hunger back for golf or, you know, figure something else out. And so I really wanted a way to make a good bit of money quick and maybe possibly fund myself to go back playing golf. Mm-hmm. And I thought that really would help with being driven and dedicated more. So I got behind the bar and I said, oh my gosh, this is unbelievable. Like, this is so much fun. Like, it's a show. Like, it is a show. Like, yeah. I juggled and did all that. Like, I mean, we didn't just make a drink. If you ordered right. a screwdriver, there was going to be something flying through the air while I was making it, whether it was the glass coming over the top of my neck and coming around back, or whether it was the bottle getting flipped in the air, something was flying through the air. And I just loved the restaurant business.
Inglis was thriving in his work as a bartender. He stayed at TGI Fridays for quite a while before moving on to a new opportunity at Dead Dog Saloon in Merle's Inlet.
Charlie Campbell, the owner, had just purchased it, and he owned Dead Dog Saloon. It was right up here on 26th Avenue. They had a little place right up here on 26th, and he wanted to get to Merle's Inlet. He had made some friends from the inlet and had heard, you want to be down there. So he bought it from Linda, and I'm trying to remember Linda's last name. And he had gotten my name from some other friends from the inlet and said, hey, you got to get Inglis in there for servers, bartenders, do whatever, blah, blah, blah. So he came up, we met, and I read his background. I did background search on him because I'm like, who is this, you know, idiot wanting to get in the restaurant business? Then I saw he was CEO of Florsheim Shoes. He was CEO of Crystal Brands Corporation. And I was like, this guy is big. Like, what in the world? But he had gotten out of all that and moved down here and really just wanted to have a couple restaurants and just relax, build these up for his kids so they had somewhere, you know. And I said, yeah, I'll go. So I went down and started working with him at Dead Dog. And, of course, it's become what it is. Just an incredible place. Beautiful. Like you said, the Marsh Walk is just crazy down there. But I got from behind the bar. And I'm not going to lie, I missed it. Like, I got into the management role, and I really missed being behind the bar. And after a couple of years, I made my way back behind the bar.
Did you?
I did. It was just, I'm not programmed for the, be stuck in an office.
Yeah,
I'm not.
I get it.
I'm not
similar.
Programmed to be stuck in an office. And I just saw the opportunity. Charlie had a great manager that was working with me that deserved to be promoted. And I said, you know what? I want to concentrate on golf again. Here we go back to golf. I said, I want to concentrate on golf again. Can I just bartend? And he said, sure, let's do it. So I stayed there and started bartending and started working on my golf game again because I said, oh, I'm going to try it again.
It appeared that behind the bar was where Inglis belonged. However, at this time, he was deeply struggling with his relationship with alcohol. He began to go out after work and party, not realizing the sharp turn that his life was about to take.
Well, when you grow up in Lake City, a very small town with nothing to do other than cruise the town, I didn't know anything about all that fun stuff until I got to college, and I did get introduced to party life. And then when you're in the bar business, and I'm going to say this, bar business and restaurant business are incredible. They are careers. They are not just, if you go into it with the right mindset, if you go into it where you go to work and go home and live a normal life instead of going to work, and the next thing you know is it's 5 in the morning, and you're figuring out how you're going to get home.
Because you close, and
exactly.
Everybody's still hyped up after a busy night.
Up.
And then you have a few drinks, right?
Right.
Next thing you know, it's 5 in the morning.
And guess what? You sleep through the entire day until 3 o'clock when you got to get up and get dressed and take a shower and go to work and do it again. But you spent 3/4 of what you made that night at work at the bar.
When was your epiphany?
My epiphany was 2004-5. Probably, I think it's 2005.
Were you at Dead Dog then?
I was at
still?
Dead Dog working still. And social life had become out of bar life after work, was out of control.
Out of control meaning partying?
Partying? Yes, partying.
Yeah.
Was out of control. I felt like it was the only way to meet anybody. I mean, if I'm at work, I'm behind the bar. So the only thing to do was to go out after work. And, I mean, just every night it was going out. And one night I called a cab to get home, which was a smart decision.
Mm-hmm.
And some guy and girl that I didn't even know hopped in the car in the cab with me and said, let's go party. I said, y'all come on. We go back to my house, which was not my house. It was my brother's and his girlfriend at the time, apartment. And as bartenders, we kept a lot of cash around the house. Well, they came to the house. I woke up the next morning, literally didn't remember having anybody at the house. Fortunately, they were gone. Fortunately, nothing was missing. But I started thinking about what could have happened.
Mm.
You know, I didn't know these two from Adam's house cat.
But you were drunk at the time when they got in.
Oh, I was drunk, yeah, when they got in. I said, let's go. Y'all come to the house. We're partying.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. I woke up the next morning. This is where finally showed a sign of maturity. And I said, that's enough. Like, I knew that I had taken the chance to have thousands of dollars stole from Warren and Sonny and myself and put myself in danger. And I called my mom and said, hey, listen, I am going to stop drinking for a while. Can I come stay with y'all? And she's like, I'll come get you. I'll be there tomorrow. So we met with Charlie, the owner of Dead Dog. She and I sat on the porch. We talk about this a lot. I have a lot of respect for Charlie. We sat outside on the porch, the beautiful deck at Dead Dog, and I said, Charlie, I need help, and I've got to get away for a while. I just want to make sure I got a job when I come back. And he said, absolutely, and you've got my full support and respect. And he looked at my mom and said, y'all go get him help and do whatever, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I maybe my problem wasn't as much that I just enjoyed the drinking side of it. My problem was using it as a crutch.
A crutch for what?
A crutch for other things that I was missing in life. I think other things that I had let go and wasted opportunities. And so for me, like, no offense, but that high after work of being the life of the party and spending money and buying drinks for everybody in the house, to me, that was my opportunity to make up for the golf opportunity that I lost and other things.
Did you at any point have a moment of surrender when you were going through that? Did you experience that?
I really believe that morning that I woke up after taking that ride home in the cab with those two
strangers.
Yep. And my younger brother, having to play the big brother role the next morning and honestly making me realize how much we could have lost had those two. I mean, as it turned out, they weren't bad people, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't. I'll just say that. But
that's good.
But we didn't know that.
Right?
I didn't know that. But had they gone through and gone looking through, I mean, I passed out. Like, literally, from what I understand, when we got home that night, I completely passed out, like literally like got a beer or something out of the fridge, and I passed out, leaving two strangers in the house. So they let themselves out the door, locked the door, and fortunately didn't take anything.
But, thank goodness for that. But it was a major wake-up call.
After that tongue lashing from my younger brother, I think I knew at that point that it could have been any number of things. Like I could have not gotten in that cab. I could have tried to drive home that night and killed somebody. I had to go get help. And I think the best part of it is that I realized it. I recognized it. It didn't take somebody telling me I needed help. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I was able to do it without like a great support group like AA or somebody like that, that I knew I wanted better. I knew. Right. I knew that I wanted to better myself. I knew I needed to. So I leave and I go to Florence with my parents. And, you know, they're like, okay, we've got to get you help, blah, blah, blah. And they reach out to a family friend who was at that point in time, he was a lawyer. So they reach out to him and Dr. Marion Fowler. His dad was our family doctor growing up in Lake City. But Marion said, yeah, bring him to me. And I want to spend some time with him. And Marion and I just sat in his office and we talked for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours went by. And he finally looked at me and said, have you never been diagnosed with ADHD? And I'm like, no, but, you know, we did have one doctor in the mountains that said I probably should try something for ADHD. I truly believed that I had it, that I have it still. You know, I don't think you grow out of it. I do think you need chemical help. But Marion said, we're going to try something. And he said, rifampin is something that I can do. He couldn't do a schedule one or whatever the Adderall Ritalin would be. But he said, I want you to try this. And rifampin at that, not rifampin, Strattera had come about and become popular. And it was a hormonal-based medicine for it. And I got on it. And boy, 3 days later, I was like, oh, my, I was ready to get off of it. I wanted to throw it in the pond behind Country Club of South Carolina where my dad was a golf pro at. And it was just horrendous, the side effects. And I'll tell you, it made a big difference. Everybody around me knew it. I mean, that was like, that was when the TV show started and everything else.
Why? Because it kind of calmed you down?
It calmed me down into focus. Like instead of sitting here right now, like I'm doing, thinking about a meeting I have at 5:30 at Sarah J's, I focus on what we're doing now.
Did it help you stop drinking, do you think? Or
I think it helped me with the focus side of it. I think instead of... the biggest thing, I think, was that I started focusing on goals. Instead of living for that instant high, drunk, in my case, living for that at night, I actually had goals. And goals were, at that point in time, first off, was to either get back to playing golf and give myself a chance, or B, get a management position, you know, in sales or do something different.
Inglis's ADHD diagnosis was a major turning point in his life. His relationship with alcohol and mental health was complicated, but over time he began to understand his true purpose in life, and it wasn't bartending.
The money was great in the restaurant business, it was, but I knew for me, I was dating my wife, now Kim, who had graduated from Clemson, who was a professional, worked for Sun News here locally at that time. And I knew my hours were completely different than hers.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's rough.
So for me to better myself and give myself the opportunity in a relationship, I knew I needed to make those changes. And so I started focusing on things and fishing just, you know, I don't know. It's just crazy. But I really wanted to figure out how to catch every single fish in Merle's Inlet.
Well, when did that start?
I went AWOL in March.
From your job?
Yeah, I went AWOL and from the drinking and the job. And then I came back and I worked through the summer, worked the first summer, not drinking at all. But then in the fall, my uncle had brought his boat down and said, hey, can we keep the boat behind Dead Dog some? You can use it. I can use it. And I asked Charlie and he said, sure. And I started, and it was like the end of August, and I started fishing every single day. And so I would get off work, and all I thought about was waking up at 6:30 to go fishing. And that just in itself, I could not go out and get drunk. I was not going to get up. I knew what I'd feel like. So I went home. I'd get excited. I had junk for fishing stuff. I like borrowed some rods, and then I like grabbed tackle that had sat in my dad's garage for years and literally just had to kind of work with that. That's all I could afford. But I had that boat and I had the opportunity and I just kept going. And I think for me, it just became like with golf where I wanted to figure everything out. And like I had to teach myself everything in golf. I had to teach myself in fishing. Then that focus just stayed there. And like I said, I had very little help. And those that did help me, and they all know who they are, I don't even have to say their names, but those that did help me are still close friends and they knew how serious I was. I mean, I've come a long way. I would get sick every time I went out.
Did you got used to it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I think the biggest difference is when you're behind that steering wheel and you're in charge of the boat, your mind is on so many other things. It's not even, you're not even thinking about getting seasick. It was crazy. I got my captain's license. I had my hours. I was legal, but I had put my hours in. 138 days, I think it was, that every day solid I was on the water for at least 4 hours. It really and truly was fulfilling. Like, I'd love to come back to Dead Dog Course. Marsh Walk had gotten built by then. So that was, you know, I had a couple of people say, hey, man, we want to fish with you. Okay, well, we go fishing, blah, blah, blah. And then I said, Kim, my wife, Kimmy, looked at me and said, if you're going to continue to fish like this, you need to figure out a way to make money doing it.
Right.
And, of course, I'm using a loaner boat that I would not even want to take a charter on anyway. And we ended up, I went to sea school, got my license, and my mom helped me buy a smaller boat to start off with. And we ran that boat for a year under T to C was the name of my charter business, Golf T, T-E-E-2-C, and ran that business for a year and then decided we need a little bit bigger boat. So we bought a bigger boat and then started doing charters and, I loved it. Don't get me wrong. I did. But eventually, and I have the utmost respect. I represent several charter captains, magazine, radio, podcast, whatever. And they are like my heroes because they're the ones that are willing to go on days when you don't really want to go fishing. But I found myself in a position after, I think it was 7 years, found myself in a position that I just didn't want to go fishing. And I said, the minute I woke up, because it wasn't fair to my customer, the minute I woke up that I did not want to go fishing, that I was done. Like, the charter fishing thing was over. And it was in August, and I had an unbelievable charter. Unbelievable. Caught so many fish, clean fish for 2.5 hours. They tipped me 47 cents. Literally 47 cents. I could count it. Like, it was change
oh my gosh.
They put in my hand. And it just struck me wrong. I don't know why. I don't know if maybe I was kind of getting over it anyway. There was some competition coming along. It was price gouging, and they were undercutting us, and I just was kind of maybe had a bad taste in my mouth anyway for it. And I said, you know what, this TV stuff that I'm doing now, because I'd already started, I didn't even get there, but I'd already started the TV show. And I said, maybe I'll just push harder on the TV side of it. And that fall, sold my boat, got rid of my boat, however you want to disclose, I got rid of my boat, and I started concentrating on the TV and radio show, well, TV stuff at that time, and continued to fish but didn't do charters.
Inglis's newfound love of fishing altered the course of his life. And although he only did fishing charters for a short while, the opportunities that came from that experience were astonishing. Not long after selling his boat, he found himself fully immersed in the world of radio and television.
South Carolina Outdoors, make sure I say that right. South Carolina Outdoors is a show based out of Florence. They've been around for a while. And a good friend of mine, Jay Gregg, was the host. I had been a host of it for 2 years. I had done a duck hunting show with him. He invited me to come do a duck hunting show with him, but we had never done a fishing show. And he came down. He had some sponsors to entertain and wanted to film a show with me, King Mackerel Fishing. And I said, sure, come on. So we got in the boat and we took off. And listen, I love Jay. Jay, welcome to the Grand Strand. Jay is a new Horry County DNR officer here. and we are still close and good friends. But Jay and I went and went out, and we went kingfishing. And every time Richard, the cameraman, would start talking to us, I kind of took it over. I didn't mean to. I was just, I did not do it on purpose, but I was going into details, like the rig and different things. And so we got the show done. The guys had a blast, the sponsors. And then I get a call from Jay's boss who said, will you come meet me in Florence? I want to talk to you about something this week. And Jay, in the meantime, had already called me and told me that he was thinking about doing another television show and wanted it to be just saltwater. And so I went up, met with him, and we talked, and he made it sound so appealing. And then I started thinking, oh, I'm going to be a TV star. And so I was like, yeah, this sounds wonderful. Like I told you, the one thing I didn't ask was, how much do I make doing this? So I came back to the beach and started, he wanted me to come up with a name. So I started trying to figure out a name. And we sat around at Dead Dog one night. I was closing shift, and we were sitting there, and I think Charlie might have been there, my brother, but we were all just jotting names down, just coming up with names. And, of course, the one rule was that I was going to be Captain E. Charlie had already come up with that. Charlie had started calling me E when we opened Dead Dog because he and his wife, Bev, were having so much trouble with English that they just started calling me E. So the TV thing, they were like, Captain E, you got to be Captain E. You can't be English. It's going to be too confusing. You're Captain E. I'm like, all right, that sounds great. I'll be Captain E. So we came up with Reeling Up the Coast.
Reeling Up the Coast was a big success, and Inglis loved sharing his passion for fishing with his community. He continued to host the show, and he loved every minute of it.
I've worked with Robert, the owner of Cycle Outdoors, for about a year and a half, and then I decided to do it on my own. It was just coordinating cameramen with him in Florence and me and traveling and reimbursement of expenses and everything else. It was just made more sense for me to do it by myself. One of the cameramen lived here at the beach that they were using, and he and I worked together well. I was real good friends with him, and we had fun. We filmed 2 years of great television. An outdoor cameraman, if you find a good one that can go on a boat, you better hug him, kiss him, and pay him well.
What do you think made you a good TV host for fishing?
I think that probably the fact that I try to, first off, be myself. First off, I try to be myself. I don't try to act any way different. I'm not Bill Dance. I'm not George Poveromo. I'm not Mark Davis, any of my heroes. I'm not them. I'm myself. And I also think that people watching an outdoor television show, they can respect and love the fish that you're catching, but they really will respect and love you more if you show them how you're doing it. If you tell them and explain to them how you're doing it.
Right.
I mean, I want them to feel like they're on the boat with me. Like when I'm doing it, like I want them to feel like, and I want them to turn around and go, that's a guy I want to fish with. Like I could fish with him. It just, I don't know, it just suited me perfectly. And again, I think that I found myself like really diving into how and when and being genuine. Mm-hmm. I think genuine, no matter what, radio, television, it doesn't matter. It's being genuine. I don't have a character. Like I am Captain E.
You are the character.
I am exactly. I am complete chaos on a boat. I go crazy. I do everything 110 miles an hour and I screw up and that's just me. That's just how it goes. And I joke around and call it organized chaos, but that is sarcasm at its finest. But I just felt like it was a perfect fit for me and, the television stuff. I just wanted to be genuine. I just wanted to be genuine, and I wanted to be honest, sharing my experience, sharing how I came from golf to bartending to fishing and now media and marketing. But I truly did enjoy it. You know, unfortunately, local television can only be so big. And without the right pieces to the puzzle, you're not going to ever go anywhere else, and that's okay. And I was fine with that. Like, that's my speed. I mean, my experiences with Let's Fish TV are now basically my dreams back then, and I'm getting to do it, and it's like it's nothing. Like,
how did you get Let's Fish TV then?
So Let's Fish TV, Barry Stokes was the old owner and host, and I have been with them for 9 years. This will be 9 years with Let's Fish TV. Barry Stokes was the old owner. He put out an open audition for anybody to send a video in if you want to report on your area about fishing. And that's all he asked for. So I went in my front yard, and I was already doing my TV show. But I went in the front yard, and I filmed talking about the Carolinas, talking about a saltwater and freshwater report, did it, and sent it in. And he called me immediately after it, and he said, so, blah, blah, blah. And we had to talk, and he said, I want you to work with us this year. He said, I want you to try it. You'll be my Carolinas reporter. And I said, Barry, you mean South Carolina, right? He said, no, North and South. I said, Barry, you're giving me 2 minutes a week to talk about fishing in North and South Carolina? Like, he said, well, what I want you to do is go freshwater this week and then saltwater next week. Freshwater, saltwater. And everybody that knows fishing knows how hard it is for 2 minutes for you to tell somebody what's going on in the Carolinas.
Right.
And it's tough. So I do that with them. So that's kind of my dream, and that's probably the biggest TV side of it that I'll ever get to. And it's a national television show, so I'm okay with that. So with Reeling Up the Coast, the cost of airtime went up, and being a local television show, the prices that they can get from churches on Sunday mornings for our time slot are far greater than what we could afford to pay. So they moved different programming into the outdoor spots here, and the radio stuff had come about. We had, been approached and talked to Gator 107.9 about getting on there. They're obviously country music here along the Grand Strand, and the number one station, Nielsen rating. For us, that was like a home run, and they opened their arms to us, and we have been over there for 6 years. This will be March will be 6 years with them, 10 years total for the radio show, and we love being over there.
Inglis's career in TV and radio has now spanned many years, and he loves being able to talk about fishing. He continued hosting Let's Fish TV and even found time to run a magazine and host a podcast. Through all these endeavors, Inglis realized that his true passion in life was sharing the outdoors with others.
Again, I think it's just promoting the outdoors, promoting what I do, and promoting what I think made such a big difference in my life. And I think, I don't want to say it saved my life. I'm not going to go on that tangent, okay? I'm not going to say, oh my gosh, fishing saved my life. Fishing saved my life. It probably did. I'm sure that one of those nights being drunk driving around, something bad would have happened. I'm sure that I'd still be behind a bar right now somewhere, whether it was here at Myrtle Beach, probably would be here. But I think that the outdoors just mean so much. And I just genuinely feel that I love now watching through my kids' eyes. I've got a 6-year-old and I've got a 10-year-old. My 10-year-old wants to be in the dance studio. My 6-year-old, he wants to be in a boat, in a deer blind, in the woods, somewhere. But to watch it through his eyes and listen to the things that he picks up, he honestly blows me away sometimes when he talks about, and he will look at me and say, if we have a bad day fishing, he'll say, but Daddy, just think about how pretty it was out here today. And I'm like, you're right, but I don't deserve you. And I genuinely love where I live. This is a sportsman's paradise. It is. People don't look at the Grand Strand as being that, but it is. There are so many opportunities, and we live in heaven here, and I think I just have so much fun getting out and promoting it and just telling, sharing people what I get to do. And I'm blessed. I am truly blessed for the opportunities that I've had. And did I deserve them? Absolutely not. Probably somebody else deserved them more. But I just hope that somewhere down the line, somebody says, Inglis Glover got me into fishing, and I'll be happy.
Fishing has brought so many opportunities into Inglis's life. In addition to helping him build a successful career, it's also what pulled him out of his struggle with alcoholism.
I was on a endless road, I think, if you want to say it the truth, behind the bar and drinking. I was on a road that just kept going. There was nothing at the end of it. Made a little right-hand turn, and the next thing you know, I have got all kinds of stuff in front of me. Again, started taking in all the beauty and started taking in all the other opportunities that I was passing by and not making the most out of. And it just happened.
As you look back on your life and you look at what is left, potentially another 50 years or 25, you don't know. What is it you would like to leave as your legacy? You've kind of said it.
I truly just would like for people to say, you know what? Captain E was real. Captain E loved people, and he would do anything he could for anybody. He wanted to help people, and he absolutely loved his family, and he loved the outdoors and loved doing what he does. The fact of the matter is, I just would hope that when I'm gone, I hope that somebody will come up to my kids. This, my dad's still alive, but I hope that my kids get to hear what I hear right now, and that is, your dad is such a good person. Like, your dad always treated people fair. Your dad was always nice. Your dad always was willing to help. That's what I want. I mean, again, you asked why he's my hero? Now you know.
Mm-hmm.
That is truly what I would like. And I'd like for my kids to both experience what I get to experience now. And I continue to have fun. I love raising money for charities. I love teaching people to fish. I love doing good things. And I know that's what we're supposed to do according to the Bible, but it's fun. And I think that's where, you know, when I quit drinking, I keep saying quit drinking. I mean, I still will have a social cocktail, so mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, again, there. But when I quit relying on alcohol to survive,
mm-hmm.
I think I started just, it was crazy, but I realized all the things I'd been missing and everything else, and I was letting alcohol define me, and now I let other stuff that are positive define me.
Mm-hmm.
It defined me.
Yeah.
Holy crap. Alcohol helped define me. That's scary to say, but it is. But it's a good way. In a good way, I can say it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And thankful that it came that way. But
Inglis's life has been full of ups and downs, but no matter what, he's always found a way to stay true to who he is. Whether it's having fun on a fishing trip or inspiring others to explore the outdoors, Inglis loves to share how his passion helped him become a better person.
If you've been inspired by this story or any others, please take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review.
We don't just get away at the beach, we get together. Because no matter what floats your boat, we're floating right along with you. With over 2,000 restaurants, live music all day and night, and endless attractions, Myrtle Beach was made for having fun and beaching easy. Welcome to 60 miles where you belong, the beach. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Plan your trip at visitmyrtlebeach.com.